Network session number 13273, Reel 3.
We find our own winds by dropping flame floats, and we take a great number of drifts, and we find our own winds, and we even attempt sometimes to even draw our own met charts from the winds we've found. And this gives us some idea where we are, but we're not very accurate in our position. I wouldn't guarantee my position within 10 or 15 miles after I've been flying, you know, say 5 or 6 hours. So Captain Agnew said, "That's very interesting." He said, "Because I think I asked him. I said, how accurate is your navigation?" He said, "Given the stars, it's very accurate." He said, "But without the stars, he said, it's not so accurate." So we decided that it would be rather foolish for me to find a convoy, attempt to give its position in latitude and longitude, which might be, 10-15 miles out, and for him to try to find it, especially if there were no stars, and he might be a few miles out. So we worked out this thing. We said, he said, the thing it is, you've got to guide me on. You've got to guide me on by some means or other. So we evolved this thing that I would give him relative bearings, and we worked out that I could find the convoy. I could then turn my aircraft around, pick up this radio beacon, this radar beacon at over 100 miles, do a very swift calculation on the Bigsworth board, which I was still carrying on my lap, and give him the relative. You have 140 miles at a bearing of so much. And then I would repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, just going back, and of course the distance is getting smaller all the time. And this worked. He said, how are we going to communicate? And we tried various methods. At one time I carried a naval signaller on board, and the idea is I would find the enemy, fly back to Captain Agnew, and we would exchange information by Aldis lamp. Well, this didn't work. It's very difficult to fly around four ships at night and exchange information by Aldis lamp. So we then invented our own code, a thing called the SAIR code, S-A-I-R, sea to air. And we emitted, and we had about five or six signals, and we reduced it. And Captain Agnew was a wonderful man for simplicity. He said, let's keep it as simple as possible. That's why he always steamed in one formation, fought as one ship. And we had a long discussion, and we came to the conclusion there were only five bits of information he wanted. He wanted to know the course and composition of the convoy, whether it contained any ships which I thought were as large as cruisers, or larger. Above all, he wanted this relative bearing and distance, non-stop, one after the other, as many relative bearing and distance as I could give him. We came to the conclusion we had to have some method whereby I should drop flares at a certain time, if he was having trouble identifying the ships in the last stage. I forget what the last one was, but we got it down to about five pieces of information, which we reduced on our own code, and we used plain language. I had, and he had, this thing called a psycho machine, and I said, well, I guarantee any long message in a psycho machine is always received wrong at the other end. So we abandoned all thought of that. We used plain language, our own private code, and our own frequency. And off we went. And it worked. I used to find them ships, and we only acted if we knew it was likely to be a convoy. It had either been spotted by the daylight recce people, or we used our naval intelligence, what I thought was naval intelligence, which I now think was just as likely to have been ultra intercepts. But I'm sure we had naval intelligence as well. In other words, we only went out if we thought there was a chance of me finding a convoy. We just didn't go out on spec. Now, that was only part of my work in Malta. For every job I did with Force K, I probably did two or three with the Swordfish of 830 Squadron. At Malta, there were three airfields, a small one in the extreme south of the island called Halfar, housed a wonderful fleet air arm Swordfish Squadron, 830 Squadron, a most marvellous bunch of fleet air arm aviators. And they were in the same situation. They were prepared, they'd found a way of torpedoing enemy ships at night, very difficult, but they hadn't the range to look for them. So we worked out a method by which we could guide the Swordfish to any convoy we happened to find. This was quite different, but it worked quite well. In this case, one or two of the Swordfish, had a very elementary form of radar itself, ASV Mark 1 even. In this case, wonderful Al Glazer, that's the Canadian ground radar chap, he made a radar beacon and put it on my aircraft. And the Swordfish boys flew in formation at night, in cloud very often, in formation at night. They flew in formation behind the one aircraft which had their airborne radar, which homed onto my beacon. And the Swordfish boys were remarkable, and they sank an awful lot of ships. But that was a different technique. Again, Al Glazer was quite largely responsible for the successes we had. Unfortunately, nearly all the Swordfish went missing one night, and the squadron had to be reformed. And it was never quite the same after, although it picked up, although they got a new CO in, Sir Frank Hoskins, who became Admiral Hoskins later on, and it did pick up. But the Swordfish sank a lot of enemy ships, and I'm very proud to have been associated with a wonderful bunch of fleet air arm flyers.
Did you ever get engaged in action with any of the Rommel convoys yourself?
Not with a convoy, because my job was to hunt, for ships. And for that purpose, I carried as much as 1,030 gallons, if you know your Wellingtons. Well, that's full wing tanks and full tanks in both bomb bays, 140 gallons each in each bomb bay. I think I once did 14 and a half hours in the Wellington, which must be a record, I should think, nearly. So with absolutely loaded to the eyebrows or loaded at the maximum of fuel, you know, especially if I was using both my bomb bays full of fuel tanks, I had no means of carrying bombs. But if, for instance, I was looking for some convoys round about Pantelleria, which is the Italian island about 150 miles from Malta, then of course the rain problem so much, and sometimes I carried a few bombs as well. And there was one occasion when I managed to find a ship and attack it at night, and we managed to hit it. But that's almost the only time I ever carried bombs. Hugh Pugh made it plain that my job was to find ships and not particularly to risk the aircraft that, you know, attacking them myself. Because owing to the losses on the ground, I was carrying most of the load of the SDF myself for a long time, because the squadron leader got posted away, the other pilot went a bit work shy, and I had to promote the co-pilots of both the other two to command the aircraft of the other two pilots, and there was no means of giving any duel or anything in Malta, because we were so strictly forbidden to fly in daylight. We were much too vulnerable, even with Italian fighters, you know, in around the island. And so it was a one-man band for quite a while, but one of the co-pilots, you know, turned out to be very able, and became my right-hand man, I'm quite a well-known author now, by the way, David Beatty, B-E-A-T-Y. He's written about 20 or 30 books, largely with an aviation background. And I was able to convert my own co-pilot, who had been with me ever since Bertram Newton, and he commanded the aircraft. But the trouble was to keep three aircraft serviceable.
Did you have any dangerous moments in those flights?
Yes, largely due to the weather. All these aerials picked up ice, and we had no means of de-icing them. Once winter comes, I mean August, September, well, we started September, October's fine, but around about November, it began to get very cold and wet and miserable, and we were always picking up ice on the aerials and the aircraft. We had no de-icing equipment on, nothing on the wings, nothing on the propeller, nothing in the carburetors, and we were fighting ice over and over again. We were in and out of cloud at night with low temperatures, ideal for ice. And we once got lost, hopelessly lost, and the radar was on the blink, it wasn't working, and I couldn't find Malta, and only by the skin of our teeth did we manage to get back with almost dry tanks. I was saved by for the only time in my flying life I actually sent out an SOS, and one of the ground radar stations in Malta, you know, picked me up and gave me a bearing. But I don't think we suffered from the enemy very much. You know, we all got bombed on the ground, but you got very used to that. Most of the bombing, which became very intense round about from December onwards, became very intense because the Hitler moved. He had three air armies facing the Russian front, and round about December, when the Russian front became rather stabilized in winter, he moved one of his three air armies, one third of his air force, facing the Russians, and put it into Sicily, and tried to neutralize Malta by bombing. And we all had escapes on the ground, but on the whole, it was probably safer in the air than on the ground. Apart from the ice.
Did Captain Agnew, was he satisfied with the recce work that you did on behalf of K?
Oh, he was terrific. I mean, I was young, optimistic. It only occurred to me years afterwards what a remarkable man he was, because in effect, I mean, he was in charge of several thousand people on board four warships. In effect, he was just following my my signals. He was, in effect, he was giving me operational control of his four ships. He went where I told him to go. And not every following naval captain is going to do that.
Can we say a little bit about the siege of Malta and the privations involved for both the civilians and the army and the armed personnel?
Yes, indeed. I'm very proud to talk about that. Because to be in Malta was really terrific. Everyone who was in Malta at the time all say the same thing. It was wonderful to be there because it was the kind of air force you'd never seen anywhere else. We were all under incessant bombing. Very few people realize the kind of bombing, the scale of the bombing of Malta. The total number of alerts was 3,340. And figures don't mean much, but I think the figure which impresses most people is in the month of April 1942. More bombs fell on April in 1942 than fell on the whole of Britain during any month of the war. And when you've got to bear in mind that Malta is smaller than the Isle of Wight in area, I think it's 91 square miles in all, and that there are only four targets, at the three airfields and the harbour, and that weight of bombs, and bombs just rained down day and night. On average we got something about six or seven alerts a day. But in a way, dive bombing, I think what saved us was what made it tolerable, this sounds a very strange statement perhaps, is that It was practically all dive bombing by Ju-87s and 88s. 87s and 88s, about an almost equal number. Once you realise what dive bombing is, it's very tolerable, because once you've experienced a few dive bombing attacks, you can see what he's diving at. And 99 times out of 100, he's diving at somebody else. Whereas if a bomber just comes over the island and drops a bomb at some time, you've not the faintest idea where those bombs are going to fall. And they might fall on you, or they might not. But let's say 99 times out of 100, you can say, almost with savage satisfaction, "Oh, poor old Takali is getting a pasting." And you sit there with a smile on your face, nearly. And once you start going down the shelters, you're absolutely finished, because for one thing, you had to spend about 14, 15 hours a day in very unsanitary, unpleasant conditions, wondering what's happening, and hearing the odd thud occasionally. And I can't think of anybody who went down the shelters who wasn't finished within a matter of weeks, nearly. So you didn't go down the shelters, you watched it. And we all dug ourselves at the SDF, my flight sergeants, most of my sergeants were now flight sergeants, cut themselves a slip trench. There were hundreds of slip trenches. The Maltese rock is very, very, very soft. You can cut it with an axe, you can saw it with a saw, and they just borrowed axes from somewhere and cut themselves. A very narrow slip trench, only about 18 inches wide or something, in a zigzag fashion. And you're absolutely safe against anything except a direct hit. And you can sit there and watch it. What most of the injuries, and they're very minor injuries, but they were annoying, was from shrapnel. Because whilst the guns had ammunition, they didn't always have ammunition, unfortunately, there's a terrific barrage to be put up with these raids, and the shrapnel just came, just pitter-patter. It wasn't very large, but it's quite hot. And we all got ourselves army tin hats, and we just sort of sat in our, sort of stood in our slip trench and watched it. And it's not too bad. But the Italians, well, oddly enough, most of the Italian bombers dropped the bombs in the sea, but they're a very strange lot, the Italians. There were some formations which were incredibly brave, and they just went over at fairly high altitude, I don't know, 8, 10, 12,000 feet somewhere, very tight formation, as if giving a demonstration as an air display, never broke formation, went to all the fire and everything else. Even if one plane was in the formation was hit and fell out, the others stayed in formation. And they bombed, and of course, you never knew where their bombs were falling. But this was the exception. Most of them dropped their bombs in the sea long before they were reached the island. And then we heard of reports over the radio that of the enormous damage they'd done.
What about the food side of the siege?
Well, it got worse and worse and worse. I mean, Hitler had three decisions. If I might just go back a bit, everything that happened in Malta comes back to the what happened in October, November, September, October, November, 1941. Everything that happened in Malta goes back to that. This was the period when the Luftwaffe was fighting on the Russians. We only heard the Italians when Force K came in, when the Swordfish of 830 are doing all their damage, and most of all when the submarines were doing even more damage. We had a wonderful bunch of submarines which were kept at Slema in Solesareto Creek. Very small submarines, even smaller than the German U-boats. Oddly enough, they were U-class submarines, utmost, because they all began with the name of U, Upholder. Wanklin VC was in command of Upholder. And the combination of what the submarines were sinking, what the Swordfish were sinking, what Force K was sinking, we introduced Blenheims, and they were attacking it as a convoy with tremendous bravery during daylight. As a result, in September, October, November, we sank, between us, about 75% of the ships bringing supplies to Rommel. Now, no one can withstand this kind of loss. And Hitler was now faced with three decisions. He either had to abandon Rommel, because, I mean, clearly, Rommel was getting no supplies. North Africa itself has nothing. It has no metals, has no food, has no oil. North Africa, is as far as supplies goes, is a non-starter. And Rommel and the Italian armies there had to be supplied, not only with war material, with oil, with food. And if 75% of his supplies, and 1 month it was even more than 75%, are being sunk, Rommel's had it. And all Hitler's ambitious plans of conquering Egypt and going on to the oil fields beyond would have to be abandoned. So he had to do one of three things, as I see it. He either had to abandon Rommel and say, okay, I'll give up all dreams of capturing Egypt and the oil fields of Arabia beyond, or he could invade Malta, because the damage was being done from Malta, or he could bomb us into he could reduce Malta to rubble. Unfortunately for us, he decided to reduce Malta to rubble. He could have invaded the island. I haven't the smallest doubt in my own mind that he would have succeeded. He was reluctant to, Hitler always said, never give way a yard. He was obviously not going to abandon Rommel, because he never gave up territory, and also Rommel was his favorite general. So he decided against the invasion, although many wise people urged him to invade Malta. He had earlier invaded Crete and succeeded. So he decided to bomb us into submission, which had repercussions right through the European war. In the first place, he had his troops into the Moscow suburbs, almost in the gates of Leningrad. He took one-third of his air force out of that front and put it into Sicily. And I'm quite sure the people of Moscow and Leningrad benefited from that. He did something perhaps even more disastrous to the war on the whole. He withdrew more than half the U-boats in the Atlantic and moved them into the Mediterranean. Admiral Dönitz was absolutely furious. At that time, he was winning the Battle of the Atlantic, hands down. Over half the U-boats in the Atlantic were withdrawn into the Mediterranean. He also prepared for the invasion of Malta. It had a code name, Operation Hercules. And he got 100,000 troops ready, largely in France. Nearly 500 Ju-52s standing by for his airborne troops. And they were never used. So those 3 months, when we sank, approximately 75% of supplies going to North Africa had repercussions right through the whole of the European war, right in the middle of the Atlantic or the gates of Leningrad. And we suffered appallingly from the... Now, apart from bombing us almost non-stop, he also cut us off supplies. You see, he had so Ju-87s, 88s in Sardinia, obviously... In Sicily, that's where most of his air force was, in Sicily. And Sicily is only 60 miles from Malta. In Crete, Greece, North Africa itself, and it became almost impossible for ships to reach Malta. It wasn't the Italian Navy or the German Navy or even the U-boats, although the U-boats were partially responsible. It was the dive bombers. The dive bombers hit it, and E-boats based at Pantelleria, amongst other places, and in Sardinia. And Malta got cut off from all supplies. And we were being starved out. And we very, very nearly had to surrender to loss of food.
Did your health suffer personally from the lack of food?
Personally, I got very run down. I think I was operating night after night. I was operating a lot of time, 11-hour sorties at night, and not getting an awful lot of peaceful sleep in daytime. About three times I was bombed out where I was living, which was about normal anyhow. And I also had to go and see Hugh Pugh at the AOC. I wasn't getting an awful lot of sleep. The food was poor. The medical services were also very short of supplies. I got carbuncles. I got a horrible carbuncle on my neck. It happened to be about the worst winter Malta has ever had weather-wise. It rained and rained, and it was cold and miserable, and I think I got flu. I got run down. We all got run down. Eventually I had to spend, you know, Hugh Pugh took me off ops and sent me up to a rest camp. We had a rest camp, a place called St. Paul's Bay, and he sent me up to a rest camp, and I was there nearly a month before I was fully recovered. I think I was far more exhausted than I realized.
Did you ever get hungry? Did you feel starved?
No, I didn't get hungry, because as air crew we were privileged. The airmen got terribly hungry. As air crew we were privileged, and as officers I think we were also privileged. Monotonous. A McConic is M&V, meat and vegetable stew. I mean, we just lived on McConaughey's meat and vegetable stew in our mess. I gather another mess lived on tin pilchards. And I think so neither Ivor or I have ever wanted to eat McConaughey's meat and vegetable stew again. We ran out of... there was a black market kept us going. And the black marketeers were extraordinarily good to the RAF. And I think Hugh Pugh allowed it, or the governor allowed it, because there were one or two places where we knew where we could get eggs.
What was the exchange on the black market? Eggs for what?
Well, we didn't. As RAF air crew, we were very fortunate. We didn't have to go to the black market. We just went to the bars and clubs which we knew were run by this chap called Tony, the black marketeer, and he couldn't do enough for us. He wouldn't even charge us nearly. So we were very fortunate.
So he gave you the eggs free?
If he wanted them. Yes, there was Eddie's Bar and the Mayfair Hotel, and I was never conscious of lack of food, as lack of variety. And but as I say, we were RAF air crew, and we were favoured. Only after I've done all this research and written books about it afterwards, I realised how much the airmen suffered. Also, I had transport. I had the second best car on the island. The poor airmen had to walk everywhere because there was a petrol shortage, an acute petrol shortage. But I was never... I don't know, Flight Sergeant Dale always made sure that, you know, my Plymouth had petrol. I don't know where he got it from. I suspect it was aviation. I didn't ask.
Where was Eddie's Bar?
Eddie's Bar was in Bulleta. And it was one which, although the Army, the Navy and the Air Force fought more closely and were more integrated and more fought as brothers on that island than anywhere else in the war, nearly, because they were all dependent on each other. Eddie's Bar, for some reason, we decided was for officers of the Air Force and Navy only. Don't ask me why. And we used to throw out the Army officers. Although we fought so shoulder to shoulder, that was our bar, Eddie's Bar. And we had a... It could only happen in Malta. Most extraordinary things happened in Malta. We had an Army officer who was one of our RAF intelligence officers, a chap called Ian Gamage. I had a letter from him about 3 days ago only. He lives near Woking now. Ian Gamage. And he was RAF intelligence officer. Don't ask me why. He was an army lieutenant. It only happened in Malta. All extraordinary things happened in Malta. And we used to bring Ian into Eddie's Bar with a fighter escort saying, "Now don't throw him out, chaps. He's one of ours." It helped to be crazy in Malta. We were all half crazy. It was... I mean, David Beatty...